Life can be an extraordinary adventure. More than ordinary. In the gym. At home. At work. More than ordinary. Advice. Without the new agey bullshit.
Welcome to More Than Ordinary, brought to you by Seven Generation Games. I'm Maria Burns-Ortiz.
And I'm Anne-Marie DeMars.
Today, we're talking about education. Obviously, we make educational games, so that's a big part of what we do and what we think about all the time. But we're not just talking about, oh, the important things you need to do in a classroom and education's important. Yeah. Everyone says it's important, but we're going to get a little bit more in-depth with that. We have a really great educator joining us a little bit later in the show in Jimmy Sanchez.
We were talking earlier where you say that you feel like a lot of people undervalue education.
This is one of my pet peeves where people say things like, well, I don't need a piece of paper to show me how smart I am. And that discounts the fact that everything, all the effort, all the work, all the energy that goes into getting that, it's not a piece of paper. It's a degree. It's a degree that shows all the hard work and effort and education and time and, you know, understanding research and literature that you put into getting that degree. And to undervalue it as, oh, it's just a piece of paper. Who cares? It's a real pet peeve of mine.
Right. It's not just a piece of paper. Like I took out a piece of paper, wrote down, Maria Burns-Ortiz has a PhD. No, that's just a piece of paper. And I find it really annoying. Like you said, we're looking for an administrative assistant at the moment. And I was talking to someone today and said, we prefer somebody who has at least an AA degree. Because what that says to me is that you can get your act together enough days over a period of 2 years or 3 years or however long it took you to convince somebody to give you that piece of paper. And getting your act together is a significant part of being successful in any job, I think, and definitely a job with our company. It shows that you can show up, that you can meet deadlines.
And I would go as far to say that many of those people that write a degree off as just a piece of paper, not all of them, I'm not saying you have to have a degree to be successful, but a lot of people that write it off as, oh, it's just a piece of paper, don't tend to have their act together.
Right. I don't hear too many people who have a degree saying, oh, it's just a piece of paper. In fact, I've never met anybody that says, you know what I wish I'd done differently in life? I wish I hadn't got so much education.
Well, and I think that comes with experience, you know, understanding the value of a degree. Understanding the value of an education in your life, whether it's in your workplace or it's at home or it's in conversations with other people, there's a real need for better education in this country. And I think anybody could stand to be better educated, even geniuses like ourselves.
It's what I think an education gives you. First of all, as I said, a little bit of structure and discipline. No matter how brilliant you are, you have to meet deadlines. Most companies don't say, oh, we would like that new product, but whenever you get around to delivering it. It enables you to explain what you're doing to other people. Maybe you understand that program you wrote beautifully, but if you can't explain it to someone else that could then take and extend on it, it's not as useful. So like you said, you learn that communication, literacy, all of those things you pick up from an education, hopefully, are going to be beneficial in the workplace. It's not just a piece of paper. It's a piece of paper that signifies you have certain types of knowledge and skills. And it's not, as you said, that someone without a degree will never have those, but the probability, speaking as a statistician, is higher that a person with a degree has them than a person who doesn't.
And we're talking to, it's just kind of rude. It's a way that people who don't have degrees tend to use that terminology to put down people that do.
It is. It's really devaluing the effort people put out. When someone says to me, I don't need a piece of paper to teach at the university level. Well, you know, it took me 5 years to get that piece of paper. It took me 5 years to get a PhD. And boy, you must really be a lot smarter than me that you don't need to do that. That you're so much more amazingly brilliant than me. That you didn't need to take all those courses, you didn't need to write all those exams, and you didn't need to write all those programs, and you didn't need to write all those papers. You're so brilliant. You just don't need a degree. Yeah, it sounds really arrogant to someone who did put in all the effort.
But, you know, talking about education isn't just talking about the education that we have or anybody has. You know, it's not just talking about your own classroom experience, but looking at, especially given our guest today, teachers and the essential role that they play in education. What do you think, and both of us have taught somewhat, you've taught a lot more than me, but what do you think goes into being a really good teacher?
First of all, you have to know your subject. That seems pretty obvious, but I run into people who say, I think I'd be a good math teacher because I was so bad at math.
Wait, seriously?
Oh, yeah. Because they had such trouble understanding it, they feel like they could relate to kids that have difficulty. Well, I kind of see that point, but as someone who also is in sports, I don't see that many people say, I think I'd be a good coach because I sucked as an athlete. I do understand that to be a good teacher, you need to relate to just as much the students who are struggling as the students who are excelling. You need to be able to identify where students are likely to have difficulty. So you need to know your subject and you need to know how to teach your subject. Those are two basic things that are not the same. And I think you need both of them.
I would totally agree because I think there are some teachers that are really good masters of their subject level, but have a really hard time communicating it. Jennifer and I had the same history teacher in high school, and she thought he was great because he knew so much about history. And she's someone who's really passionate about history. And in my experience, pretty much everybody that had him just thought he was very unengaging. You know, he would drone on and lecture and kind of that monotone thing. When you're teaching high school students who are mostly in history class because they're forced to be in history class, they aren't able to get past that part where it's just, and today we're talking about, and they start to tune out. So she was able to, because she was really, really passionate about the subject and able to listen past that poor delivery, I would say, and see a huge wealth of knowledge that I think pretty much the vast majority of students that had him were never able to get past, because it's this idea of understanding your subject and really, really well, but also being able to communicate that with the audience of students that you're working with.
But then there's one more thing that I think, even though you haven't taught a lot as a parent, you can probably relate to, and that is classroom management.
Well, in my case, I taught at the college level, so I think classroom management is a little bit less of a challenge than, say, in the elementary school classroom. But having not taught in elementary, well, I volunteered in elementary school classrooms, and so I would say definitely college classroom management, much more difficult for kids that are kids as opposed to young adults.
You never had any of those story questioners in your class?
I did, but story questioners I feel are a lot easier to deal with than quit running with scissors. Please sit down. Oh my God. Just you, come over here. You, sit down here. And that's the way I feel like I do not know how elementary school teachers do it. I mean, my hat goes off to them because I have trouble wrangling three children and they spend all day not only wrangling, but actually teaching and conveying information and doing projects with and not going every day. Oh my God. Ah!
I love teaching middle school. But elementary, like the, you know, kindergarten, first graders, oh my God, there's not enough Prozac for me to be able to do that. And people who think teaching is easy, oh my gosh. I remember when Ron and I were going to teach Sunday school. And so we did it together as a couple and we taught preschoolers because you and your sisters were in preschool. And one day I was sick. So he had to go by himself. I think I was pregnant with Rhonda. The next week, I went back. The class was just really out of control. We had a piano bench, and if they were bad, they had to sit on the piano bench. And I think he stayed home that day. And I came home, and I said, gee, Ron, I felt like a really mean teacher today. Because I, at one point, had every kid in the class sit on the piano bench. I mean, not at the same time, but every one of them got, you know, literally benched. And he said, well, don't feel bad, because last week, I threatened to set them all on fire. I said, you did not. He says, yeah, I don't know how people teach classes of little kids. He said, I went home early. I told him that my wife is pregnant. She's not feeling well. I had to leave. He said, I'm probably going to hell for lying to get out of teaching Sunday school.
Yes, but you were talking about the importance of classroom management.
I think it's a personality factor that you just have to decide. You're in charge.
Yeah, my husband was being an adjunct faculty member at USC, and I was saying, you know, don't let them see your fear, you know, and that's not really, but that's kind of the way I feel like when I went in, especially because I started teaching as an adjunct professor and I was relatively young. I was maybe honestly 5 years older than a lot of the kids in my classes. And you have to go in there and there has to be this authoritative sense. It's not I'm so much greater than you and I know what you're doing, but you have to go in and you have to be convinced. And part of it, I think, comes from knowing your subject matter, but knowing that this is how you're going to teach it and this is how you're going to manage it.
I think it goes down to deciding that you're the teacher and they're the student and you're not on an equal basis.
Yes, that's exactly what I meant. It's not about being nervous or being cautious, but it's just this idea of being authoritative. And I think something comes with that. And that's your expertise and your skill level and your understanding of the subject. And you have to sit up because there are kids, especially I would say in college, that want to argue with you that your points are equal. You know, well, I don't think you should use this, you know, it was writing. So I don't think sentence needs periods at the end of every sentence, things like that. Well, it doesn't really matter if you think that two periods are more effective to making a point than one, because that's not the way it works. And this idea of it's not all negotiable.
Right. That's why I love teaching statistics too. Like, you know, the standard deviation is the square root of the variance. If the variance is 49, the standard deviation is 7. And we don't have a class discussion about it.
Well, there's actually no grammatical structure where two periods is ever okay either. But I found that sometimes students, especially maybe at liberal arts type colleges, think that everything is up for debate, even statistics.
Oh, yeah. You get that in math classes, too. I mean, Dennis used to teach physics and students would come in and they would say, well, I got this problem, this answer, and my friend got this answer. What do you think of that? And Dennis would say, well, I think you're both wrong. It's not popular vote, you know? Getting back to that, this is one of the things I'd really like to talk to Jimmy about, too, is this notion of having that intrinsic authority in the classroom. You see people, Jose Gonzalez, who we'll have on here later, has it. Jennifer, our lovely Jennifer, who refuses to come on the podcast, but we will drag her in eventually, has it. I was at judo class one day. This seems like off the topic, but it's not. And one of the kids came in. And I said, where's your brother? Because he did judo too. And she said, he got in trouble. And I said, well, what happened? And she said, well, the teacher was disrespecting him. Okay, I questioned that part. The teacher probably told him to sit down or something. But she said, the teacher was disrespecting him. And he got up and he threw a desk. And the teacher got scared. And she called her mom at home. And her mom had to come in. And I was in trouble. The part that I couldn't really understand is where the teacher got scared. Now, this kid, I knew him. He was a sixth grader. And okay, he was probably 150-pound sixth grader. But I guarantee you this. There is no sixth grade kid on earth that I would back down from. And if I tell somebody to sit, they're going to sit. And I think it comes from that decision I made probably 30 years ago when I started teaching that whatever comes out here at the end of this, I'm going to be standing. I just didn't understand how she could be afraid of this sixth grade kid. If he says he's not going to sit down, you walk up closer to him and say, you need to sit down now. And if he walks to the door, you walk over and you say, you need to sit down now. And there are one of two picks. He's going to run out of your classroom, at which point it's somebody else's problem, or he's going to sit. There's no, I'm calling your mother. So it'll be interesting to hear Jimmy and Jose speak on that later this week.
See, I think you have a very different perspective from a lot of people, because I think there's a lot of people who would see a third option or that are afraid of people. You could fight anybody. You know what I'm saying? Like they'd say, well, what if the kid reaches out and decks me? You know what I mean? I think there are people that really believe that. And every once in a while, you see some kind of video where something happens like that. Or they throw a chair. I mean, if somebody throws a chair in your face and you get hit with a chair, that would hurt.
Well, I think it's the same as being in a fight. And yeah, I've been in a lot of fights. And you have to decide what you're willing to do ahead of time. And I've told students before who said, you can't hit me. You're mistaken. I mean, physically, I'm capable of hitting you. I may have to deal with some adults in your life. I may have to get a lawyer, but it would be ill-advised for you to take a swing at me.
So are you saying you wouldn't call a kid's parents if they threw a chair at you?
No, what I'm saying is I think in classrooms that have good management, it doesn't get to that point that the students either like you enough or respect you enough or are afraid of you enough that they wouldn't do that. Because they're not quite sure what you might do about it.
Like I said, never let them see your fear.
I have no fear. And with that, we will open it up to our guest.
Legs just stand up on a Quest show where Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure is up against Forbidden Planet, and somebody just voted for Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure.
Welcome to Game Fights, the Ponzi scheme of podcasting. I'm David Shaw. With me, as always, is Mr. Mike Ortiz.
So what are we fighting about this time, David?
Best sci-fi movie of all time, best token minority, best animated TV series.
Listen.
GeekFights.net.
You're listening to More Than Ordinary by Seven Generation Games. You're never too young or too old to be more than ordinary.
Welcome back to More Than Ordinary, presented by Seven Generation Games. I'm Maria Burns Ortiz.
And I'm Anne Maria DeMars.
And our guest today is Jimmy Sanchez. Jimmy, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, ladies. Thank you for having me.
So our first question, you have been in education for 15 years in a, as one might politely say, challenging circumstance and an inner city middle school.
An interesting school.
Right. And lots of people say, oh my God, I would never teach middle school, or I would never teach in an inner city neighborhood. So let's just start with, how did you end up in education? Because you grew up in that neighborhood, right?
Yes, I did. I actually went to Gompers Middle School. I went there, and my first job out of high school was actually being an assistant at Gompers. My sister was taking a teacher whom I had, and one day she just asked her, so what's Jimmy doing? And my sister said, I don't know. Well, we have positions here. Tell him to come and apply. And I went, and a couple months later, I started working there, and I've been there ever since.
So you were such a legend that they just demanded that you come back, huh?
Well, when all four of us went to the same school, teachers start to know you, and they start, oh, you're Jimmy's sister. Oh, you're Jimmy's brother. Oh, so yeah, kind of.
But sometimes knowing you is not a good thing.
True, but we were all good kids, so I guess it was a good thing.
Well, and you're in a school where I think it's fair to say there's a revolving door of staff and administrators.
Yes, yes, there is.
And you've been there 15 years. So what would you say is the key to your staying power, or anyone's staying power in a school like that?
Well, my thing is, I guess I relate to the kids, having gone there and having been a student, and I can see a little of myself in the kids. I can, like, when they don't feel like doing their homework or they have issues, I can kind of relate a little bit. And I think that the teachers who kind of tend to stay there the most are those teachers that can make a connection with the kids, and the kids like them. So therefore, like, they're, I don't behave better, do their work. They don't get as much resistance from the kids. So I think building a bond with them is very, very important.
And it's not just what makes you stay, but what motivates you to get up and go to the school every single day? Because it's not always easy, to put it lightly.
No, it isn't. Especially during that last month when you see the finish line. Oh, it gets so hard to get up in the morning. But I don't know, just the fact that, like, you know, some of the kids really, really do appreciate you, you know, and they're writing Thanksgiving cards and they're saying, what are they thankful for? And they put your name on it. That, like, makes your day. Like I was saying earlier, you know, sometimes you can have like four crappy days at work, but then, you know, as long as the Friday, some kid says, oh, thank you. Or, oh, I really appreciate it. Or that helped. That makes it all worth it. And you're ready to, like, re-energizes you, and you're ready to go do it again.
Well, now, you grew up in the neighborhood, and I think most people, when they think of Latino boys in middle school, don't think, oh, that guy's going to grow up and become an educator, and he'll work full time while he goes to school, and he'll volunteer in the community and help teach judo, and he'll take, you know, 5 days of his vacation time and go to Washington, D.C. and chaperone a school trip for free. And then he'll come back and go to school some more. That's not the stereotype people have of Latino youth in inner city neighborhoods. So how
did I do that?
Yes, you did. I was there when it happened. So why do you think you beat the odds?
My parents. I think a lot of the credit has to go to them. I mean, my mom has a very, very incredible work ethic that she instilled in all of us. And to her, there was nothing more important than, like, education. You know, don't worry about a job. You know, as long as you go to school, you don't have to worry about anything. And, you know, like I said, when they were being super duper strict when I was little, I thought they were the worst parents in the world. But looking back in hindsight, they were just looking out for me. They were looking out for us. My older brother, my younger brother, my younger sister, they wanted the best for us. And they didn't want us out running the streets at 10 at night with all the other kids that I grew up with, whom probably didn't fare as well as we did. So I think a lot of that credit goes to them.
How much does that make you feel like you should be a role model for the kids that you're working with? How important is that for them to see?
you know what? I try not to be a role model, but some of these kids need someone to look up to. And I don't know, like one example, I remember one kid, I used to dress up for work every day because I used to blend in. When I looked a lot younger, like I'd get yelled at for not being in class. And yeah, so I started wearing like Dockers every day and a button down shirt. One day this kid walks in and he has a button down shirt and he's a little sixth grader. And he goes, look, Mr. Sanchez, look at my shirt. And I'm looking at him like, did you dress up like that? Because I dress up like that every day. So, like I said, I would never consider myself a role model, but some of these kids need some guidance, need somebody to look up to, need somebody to help steer them at least a little bit in the right way. So if I can help in any way, shape, or form, I'll gladly do it.
Well, why not consider yourself a role model? I mean, you're not a bad role model. You're getting an education. You have a job. You've never been in any trouble. You're bilingual. You volunteer in the community. I mean, what? I think when people say it, it's because they don't want the responsibility. Feel like I have to be perfect to be a role model. Oh my gosh, you know, I can't go out at happy hour because I'm a role model.
Oh, Lord knows I love happy hour. So, yeah, you know, I mean, like I said, I'll never say, hey, look at me, do what I do or be who I am. I mean, but you know, like when the little kid comes at the end of the school year and he tells you, Mr. Sanchez, I want you to meet my mom. And then the mom comes up to you and says, oh, we used to talk so much about you. Like, and I had this kid like 3 years in a row. He talked so much about you. And I finally wanted to meet who you were. And I couldn't help but like tear up and just like, oh, like crap. So, I mean, I guess if somebody wants to think of me as a role model, I guess I'll take it.
And we're talking about you're going back to school this fall.
Yes. Sorry.
Why is that so important for you to do?
Unfinished business. I mean, like I said, I have a sister who graduated from Dominguez Hills and she got her degree and she's like the third one down. So that means my older brother didn't do it. I haven't done it yet. And she did it. So I kind of look up to her a little bit and like, oh, I have to do that. And then, you know, I have people like Sensei who constantly reminded me through the years, how's school going? Where's school? Have you registered yet?
It's nice you got your AA. So when are you getting your bachelor's degree?
Like, whoa, slow down. I mean, even like when I did get my AA and I was like, I'm embarrassed. I don't want to do the ceremony because it took me a number of years. And you said, well, it doesn't matter how long it took. You know, you got it and you should be happy that you got it. So like I said, Sensei, my mom, my sister, I have a lot of people whom I want to be proud of me.
Yeah, I have a good friend who we'll have to get on sometime, Dr. Eric Longy, who was a college president for many years. And he was at a tribal college. And he said often people would say, oh, if I go to school, it'll take me 5 years to get my degree. And he said, so what? He said, I've given out hundreds and hundreds of college diplomas on that stage. And not one of them on the back of it does it say, but it took him 5 years because AA yeah. just says you got it. In the same way with the bachelor's degree. So, yeah, I think the important thing is that you don't give up and you get it done. And that is being a role model to kids. I think that is good.
I think you and another really good friend of mine named Nacho, but we call him Nacho. He told me the exact same thing. He's like, no matter where my ceremony is, I'll go to it. So, like, you make sure you walk that stage.
This week's shout out goes to my new best friend, Mark, all the way from Nova Scotia, who donated all of our games, Spirit Lake, Fish Lake, and Forgotten Trail, to a classroom. Thank you very much, Mark. You totally rock. If you want to be like Mark, you can donate a game to a classroom or to an individual student for the measly sum of $5 for Forgotten Trail, all the way up to $500 to give every game we make to an entire school. Go to www.7generationgames.com/buy and follow the prompts, or get one for yourself because, hey, you're awesome too.
Thanks for listening to the More Than Ordinary podcast.
For more information, please go to our website, 7generationgames.com. And that's 7 as in the number 7, generationgames.com.
If you'd like to learn more about math and history, or increase your vocabulary while at the same time having fun, you can purchase our games at 7generationgames.com/buy.
You can also donate and help a much-deserving student.
And as always, please tell a friend and don't forget to rate us on iTunes.
It's never too late to be more than ordinary.